podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist?
Hello, this is not an FPL podcast. Instead, it's episode 2 of our Sunderland Till I Die watch-along. If you want to partake but missed last week, definitely head back to the previous episode where we kicked this off. We start at about 18 and a half minutes in, as per the advice in the blurb. Just say thanks quickly for all the birthday wishes on Twitter. I had a very, very nice lockdown day, but yeah, it was still cool. Still did a few bits and pieces, which definitely made the day a bit more special than every other day sitting around on my sofa in my flat in lockdown. Joined today by Nick and Stag, of course. Nick, first, you all right?
Hey, mate. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. I've been keeping busy in the lockdown. I'm doing some reading, just enjoying the hot weather in my garden, not in the park, and hanging out with my son as well. So talking about family, my dad, famous for the hashtag dad watch section, has also been busy. Tweeted recently he's designed an Amazon Alexa football challenge quiz. And if you're interested, it's downloadable for free on Amazon Alexa. And you can also email him at footballchallengequiz@gmail.com if you've got any suggestions, improvements or feedback. Just to remind, of course, who we are. We are Who Got The Assist. You can find us on Twitter at WGT_FPL, for Tom, at WGT_Nick, and at FPL Stag for Anthony. And we're also on Instagram, WGT8.FPL. So what's on the pod this week?
Evening, lads. So as Tom mentioned already, we'll be looking at Series 2, Episode 2 of Sunderland Till I Die. This episode is called The Old Fashioned Way. There is a huge number of talking points for the series itself, but also looking at various issues in the world of football and how they're portrayed within a club and how they play out within a club. But first of all, we are going to, like the last few weeks, look at the world of football and the little bit of news that has been coming out in spite of the COVID pandemic that continues to keep us all locked up in our houses.
Yeah, moment the COVID pandemic's over and we've got some FPL, we'll be back to FPL. But for now, we're on the news and we're on Sunderland Till I Die. So let's start off with that news. And it's, it only came out today, didn't it? But there's a possible return for English football on the 6th of June that's being mooted. And the Premier League apparently are offering Wembley, St George's Park to try to figure out how the hell they're going to end the season effectively. I think I saw something like 52 days, is around the sort of estimate they think they need to fulfil the remaining fixtures.
What's quite interesting is one article that was on Sports Illustrated earlier this week, and it was talking about the idea of trying to play a league in a vacuum. So there's been talk of playing the Premier League games abroad or maybe within some sort of confined space in England. There's been talk, even Juan Mata said to MUTV just this week that he expects the Premier League to be played abroad. The UFC, which obviously is a very different sport to football, but the UFC have been looking at hiring an island and keeping everyone there for the time. Major League Baseball looking at Arizona. The NBA have been looking at hotels in Las Vegas. You get the idea. The idea is effectively that players and the staff are all in quarantine for the whole duration of the league. They're shuttled to the matches. They train together. Everything basically is to avoid them having any exposure to the outside world. And this Sports Illustrated article basically popped the bubble, really, at the idea that it just can't work. So all of the people who are involved are going to have 2 weeks of isolation in advance. That's including people like broadcasters, the security, the household staff and the hotel who've been looking at people's rooms, and nobody can go in, nobody can go out. They probably won't have families within this either. Testing, they would probably have to have tests every single day for every single person involved. And anybody listening to this in almost any country in the world, they'll know that there are issues with dealing with testing backlogs as it is. So this can't happen in the near future. At the same time, because of the risks of how everything would fall apart, if one person tests positive, they would still need to social distance within this quarantined bubble. Because if one gets it, obviously, the whole thing collapses. And if someone needs medical treatment that's actually quite serious, they'll have to actually leave the bubble. So if they leave the bubble, they have to quarantine for 2 weeks before they can re-enter the bubble. And so any medical staff that are to look after the players on a day-to-day basis will have to be in there. You'll know that there's usually ambulances at every Premier League game for the whole entire duration of them to do emergency treatment, etc. They would have to be within the bubble, and once they go outside the bubble, those EMTs would no longer be available until they re-enter the bubble for a two-week period. And if one person tests positive, boom, gone. You're going to have to stop everything for 2 weeks. And that could come just as easily as if, like, someone coughs on a lettuce that's being delivered. Vacuum, it's a difficult one.
It definitely seems a bit of a far-fetched idea. I don't think I've ever heard the word bubble used in such a close proximity on the podcast before. I think that's just broken all sorts of records for frequency of the use of the term bubble. But yeah, for sure. I mean, loads of people are saying, oh, it's going to be like an international tournament. You know, they go away for 4 weeks. What's the difference? Well, the difference is coronavirus, people, seriously. Yeah, I think that it does. Like, I think we all kind of are grasping for that return of the sport, aren't we? Because it is going to be something that lifts the mood of the nation, lifts the mood of the world, whatever, if you are a sports fan. But we've got to be realistic about it as well as being optimistic. And yeah, for the reasons that Anthony's just mentioned, I just can't see it coming back until, I mean, even that's it for June date that was being discussed recently. Even that, for me, still feels fanciful. But hey, who knows?
Basically, Anthony put it very succinctly in regards to that article. It just seems very fanciful for me. I mean, we'd all love to see the football back on the 6th of June and all the Premier League players and matches taking place. But we just know that in reality, this situation, I feel like it's not going to be resolved by the 6th of June, unfortunately. It could be, you know, months and months or even until everyone is sort of vaccinated, until we can properly resume normal life again, and normal life including footballs with crowds, etc. Because you can say, okay, the Premier League can finish and do all this, and you can have, you know, people shipping the lettuce, as you put it, so that the Premier League players are firmly isolated from real life and probably their families as well. But realistically, it's just not going to work that way. It isn't plausible for us to ship off all the Premier League players off to with all the staff and coaches off to some isolated country and play a series of sort of 40 matches or whatever off-site, and then you have the Premier League. What do you do about the Championship and League One and all the other leagues? It'll just put it completely out of kilter with all of the other English divisions that are out there. This is not going to be instantaneously over, unfortunately. I feel like it could be another 12 months before we see everything back to norm. So yeah, 6th of June, as much as I'd love to see the football back then, you know, it'd be brilliant. And this whole idea of playing off-site and being isolated, I just can't see it working in practice despite all the money that's with football.
So yeah, like two things on that. So we're quite a long way away probably from having a full stadiums full of fans shouting and spitting on each other basically for whole games. It's going to be a while. And then maybe looking at more the world of football again for a second, and that is how maybe the clubs are viewing this. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was interviewed during the week on Sky with Gary Neville and somebody else. And Solskjaer was talking directly now to a question from Neville asking whether a club like Man United could exploit the coronavirus pandemic. Solskjaer agreed, effectively, saying that of course the market is going to change, prices are going to fall, and someone like United would be looking to pick up a bargain there. And actually during the week as well, one agent speaking to The Athletic said, to directly quote, "For Man United, Chelsea and Man City, buying players would be like businessmen buying businesses that are on the floor. They will see this as a way of maintaining their place at the top of the table for the next 5 years with no big transfer fees needed." Gives you an idea of probably where this is going.
Ending up with, you know, kind of that fear of the Super League sort of thing that has been mooted for so long, that you've got like a group of elite clubs that were going to soar away and have a European Super League. But I mean, what it seems to be is that obviously the clubs who have the means are going to be insulated to some extent from this to the current sort of context. And you've got others who are going to be really susceptible to it. I'd be interested to see how it all plays out. But yeah, I think that kind of the news is going to probably become more about when we're going to see at least return to training for clubs. I know like the Liga have got something in place, the Bundesliga are training with groups of five, I think it is at the moment, and it'll be really interesting to see when that happens. But that's also a bit of a segue into the final bit of the news, which also coincides with the things that made me laugh this week, which is Mourinho taking the piss out of social distancing on Hadley Common, and the players he was with as well when he was training them in his iconic sort of lilac training outfit were mind-blowing. Like, what was he doing out there with the likes of Ndombele and Sessegnon and Davinson Sanchez? What's he doing? What are these players doing out there with him? Very bizarre.
Well, I mean, Ndombele obviously was someone that Spurs spent a lot of money on. I think it was around 53 million over the course of the summer. And he was the player, as you said, that Mourinho despises. He criticised heavily, but he was criticising basically his fitness over the course of the season, saying he was unfit, couldn't complete 90 minutes, didn't have the you know, didn't have the energy essentially to complete a football match. And we all know, and I'm sure he's aware as well, that he was a fantastic footballer. That's why they spent so much money on him. He was highly praised before he came to Spurs, and his season hasn't been brilliant. But so the kind of what happened essentially is that the reports are that Mourinho, he'd already gone out for his exercise that day, and then Mourinho came knocking on his door. Sanchez and Sessegnon happened to be in the park at the same time, but apparently they all live around that area anyway, so they were all kind of like, oh, they're exercising as well. And this Ndombele has been, it's all reports, but he's apparently very unhappy about what happened when he had already exercised, and then Mourinho came and knocked on his door for this impromptu training session. And there's been, as I said, a massive flout of social distancing rules. It's caused rumbles within the senior staff and players. So yeah, not been a great week for Spurs, or great couple of weeks from Spurs.
Yeah, like even Lequipe had it, and I just imagine the imagery of this. That, so as you said, Nick, NW just finished his morning run at a virtual training session when Mourinho, without prior warning, rang his doorbell saying into the intercom, quote, "Come down, we are going for a run."
Yeah, and he was saying, "Oh, I'm really tired, boss. I can't go for a run." Mourinho was like, "This is why you're not in the team." It just seems like farcical, doesn't it? I mean, maybe that was the straw that broke the camel's back with regards to furlough as well. Like they had to, because they all broke social distancing, they then had to do something good to at least take their minds off it. But hey, another interesting week, I suppose, in our weird little lockdown world, our lockdown bubble, I suppose you put it, Stag.
Oh, right, let's take a break there.
Who got the assist?
Let's move on to Sunderland Till I Die then. And it's season 2, episode 2, the old-fashioned way. Only 30 minutes after last week's 45, but still an awful lot packed in here. And there are a few things I think that we're going to kind of hint at, talk about, and I guess in the style of the show, talk about a little bit, but leave them on simmer, I suppose, rather than bring them up to the boil for this particular episode. But yeah, I guess it opens up with a couple of slides this episode. So it states the salaries and divisions as a descending scale from Premier League to League One. £64,000 a week for the Premier League. Championship players have to make do on £14,000 a week. And the poor paupers in League One just get by with £2,000. And this is brought into stark relief by Jack Baldwin and his family. There's a little bit of uncertainty. He and his wife are saying, we didn't know where we were going to go before he signed for Sunderland. And he says, this is the pinnacle of my career. And she says, the uncertainty is really, really strange.
And I think that's where a lot of stress is in football. You just don't know what's going to happen next.
And that's kind of how the show kicks off. I guess it's kind of foreshadowing the events of the events of the series, but also the events of this particular episode too.
On the river where you used to build the boats.
Yeah, I think there's you get this huge parallel sort of between the likes of Jack Baldwin, who obviously sort of a journeyman League One type player who's on this much lower salary, and is. Life for these sort of players is very, very different and far removed from the likes of players we saw previously in Premier League experience. Obviously Jack Rodwell was the famous case from the previous series. Baldwin, I think you kind of see a different type of footballer, really, not one who's flashy and full of cash, but instead one that's sort of just lives in a modest house with family values and trying to get by, raise two children.
Yeah, and it is quite tough as well with I think it's he or his partner speaks about how the fact that if he signed his contract, then of course he would be getting money, but he didn't want to negotiate himself into a bad contract. But if he didn't have a contract, then he would have to go a certain number of weeks without money. And just like any other person, bills would have to be paid. So he was describing his summer as a limbo land. And he's talking about having a career with much more downs than ups. So really, as you say, stark contrast to an awful lot of what we've seen. So the story kind of moves through into the credits, and then we turn into seeing Josh Maja scoring a deceptive finish, is what they've said.
And that deceptive finish from Josh Maja. I tell you, that's his trademark, isn't it?
We're really starting to already see the groundwork of what Maja is to this Sunderland team, how many goals he scored, how important he is, and that is a thread that begins to run through the whole show.
They love a foreshadow on this, don't they, really? Like, it just seems to be that they'll start to put things in place that act as kind of reference points as you go through the show. Like, in episode 6, something will happen that calls back to episode 1 or episode 2. That certainly happened a lot last year, with the importance of promotion back to the Premier League, which was spelt out writ large in episode one, come episode six, they made lots of references to that, not from a position of triumphalism like they thought it would be, but from a position of schadenfreude. And they love to build these threads, don't they, in Something Till I Die?
Mm-hmm. And I think what's also good there is how, you know, even the commentary that's on that Maja goal against Burton that starts off the show is they're talking about how that finish has become his trademark finish. You know, he's scoring this goal, not just any goals, but just this particular goal so often. It kind of underlines his importance there. It kind of moves on then, and we get quite a few talking heads coming through, with Sunderland second in the league. Charlie is delighted with the fact that Sunderland have picked up two wins down south, as he puts it, against Wimbledon and Gillingham.
It's quite funny. You see a happy Charlie Meffham. He says 6 points stick it in the back pocket. It's very entertaining. You know, a bit of cockiness there showing as well. But you see, everyone, this is a good time for Sunderland after sort of time of such misery that we saw in the previous series. And previously, you know, Joyce the chef, for instance, says everyone's happy and smiling, and you see George Honeyman, who equates it to the gaffer. So it's good news. I mean, even Lee Cattermole was scoring as well, a man who managed 6 Premier League goals in 271 appearances. So yeah, really good times, seemingly, in Sunderland. But then, we move over, don't we? And we start looking at the money and the savings. And it, even though it might be good on the football pitch at this particular moment in time, in the back room, there are problems.
Yeah, there's a plentiful face palming. You've got a scene with Stuart, who's the owner, Neil Fox, one of the directors, and Richard Hill, the other director, the head of football operations, sitting around talking about the business. And fundamentally, this is what they think.
It is the biggest mess of a business that I've ever seen.
Yeah, he says the wage bill is £34 million, a non-playing bill is £12 million. They've only got £15.6 million incoming. There's a £35 million difference. It's a very mismanaged sort of business. And this really crystallised in the cryo chamber.
They invested whatever was £100,000 plus on a cryo chamber. So I speak to the heads of medical. Who uses it? And they said, well, Martin Bain goes in there for his back occasionally. And I said, yeah, but what players use it? Oh, no one uses it.
£100,000, cited as an example of that largesse, is only used by Martin Bain for his back.
Yeah, that was very entertaining. I think, obviously, we're sort of in an era now where every single Premier League club has a cryo chamber. You know, it was cited as one of Leicester's successes when in the Premier League season they won. Actually, Wes Morgan in the cryo chamber after every match was helping him stay positive and strong for every single match and keeping all those clean sheets. You know, even Jamie Vardy, for instance, got one in his house. So it's no surprise that, you know, a team of Sunderland from the Premier League would have a cryo chamber. But it's just this. The fact that they talk about its lack of use, cost them £100,000, said that only Martin Bain was using it for his back. So that's quite a funny little jab of the previous owner and the previous lack of organisation within the club, that, you know, they'd have these expenses that are just essentially going to waste.
I guess that picks up another thread here, which is kind of the shambles of the business, which was hinted at a little bit in the first episode. But it's really rammed home here and in the next scene as well. Doubt could be returned to a lot, but how does Stuart come across here, do we think? I think he does come across as the man that we're positioned behind. I think we are meant to feel sympathy for him. He's the man picking up the pieces gamely after a period of mass neglect.
I personally thought he came across quite well at this particular point. He's talking about how, while going through quite forensically all the different cuts, you know, the cryo chamber is what sticks in the mind, but they were talking about the pitch maintenance costs that they've saved as well. And he's gone through very carefully every single detail there, because he feels that he, as a director and as an owner of the club, has to work hard in every area, because of the fans that it could come to the club aren't from necessarily well-off backgrounds. And so he feels that the fans need to be able to trust the people who are administrating the club, and they want them to have that trust in them as they administer the club. And I think it's a very respectable thing to aim for, would you not?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, none of the problems that are in place at this moment in time are Stuart's doing. He's looking at what's gone on over the last 5 to 10 years at Sunderland, and he's thinking, you know, I've got a hell of a job trying to fix this up. And he's identifying the problem areas, the problems that lie within the club, and then trying to see what they can do to get rid of these issues and save monies without, you know, adversely impacting the performances on the pitch as well. So, you know, he's doing his job at this particular moment in time. So I do have a lot of sympathy for him, really, when he's sort of like looking at these books thinking, what the hell is this?
all the face palming definitely does key into that, doesn't it? And even more so, the scene this is juxtaposed with, which is a Seaburn supporters club. Charlie's in attendance, and there's a voiceover when he's saying, you know, the welcome be very, very short, and this could swiftly turn hostile if we do get this wrong. He's answering questions in front of the fans, and he says, you know, a lot of fans don't realise how bad financially the club was. I think Charlie speaks well here, especially when he's talking about the culture which pervaded under the previous administration.
The entire culture was, at the end of every month, what we do is we send a bill to a rich man in Florida and he signs a cheque and that's it.
And he picks up the thread from Stuart, I suppose, in that regard. So they're aiming to be self-sustaining, and we've learned a little bit more about Stuart later on as well in this context. But like, it feels to me like they're trying to use the fact that Stuart won't be bankrolling too much as the positive. So it becomes sort of our club rather than it being Stuart's club, and the clear sort of differentiation between the last administration, which is just sugar daddy, to now we're all in it together, I think was pretty plain here. And I think Charlie did do very, very well, kind of catching on to what we were talking about last week.
Yeah, you can certainly see that from the fans' reactions and the fans that were interviewed afterwards. You know, they were impressed by Charlie. They sort of saw the long-term plan and kind of understood it and agreed with it and, you know, signed up to his concepts. I mean, when Charlie was talking, it actually reminded me of a book I recently read by Peter Hook about the Hacienda, which was entitled How Not to Run a Club. And from Charlie's version, it's almost how not to run a football club, really. Because as Charlie highlighted, costs didn't matter, losing money didn't matter. No one really cared if the club was losing money, and they were losing money fast. And what Charlie's essentially trying to do is turn this into a profit-making business. And he's got a lot of work to do, but he's selling it well to the fans by saying, you know, it's about making this our club again and trying to, you know, bring the fans into the equation here.
So what I like about them as well, though, is that they're we've talked about this a little bit, but they're very conscious of the fact that they're kind of invading still what is someone else's club. So he mentions how, you know, he feels that he has fans' trust right now on a short lease, and that, you know, he has to earn it from here, but that, you know, at least the fans have kind of given them the benefit of the doubt to start. And as you guys say, though, it's nice in one way, and I think it's definitely convincing, as they put it, both Stuart and at this point Charlie, where they talk about the fact that once your club is funded by a rich man, it is no longer a fans club. And Charlie has a great quote there that, you know, it's our club, we pay for it, you guys just administer it. And they kind of, that's their stated aim there, and it does, as you say, Nick, seem to be very well received.
Yeah, I think what's interesting here as well is that the communication style that Charlie uses is still the same as how he was communicating within the club internally. But the style really works here when he's talking to fans, because the way he articulates things is very, very clear and very, very concise. And I think he uses a lot of key terms to get his point across in a very nice way. And when he's speaking to staff, though, I think that definitely changes. And we saw that kind of in the previous episodes when he's talking to his marketing team, and I think we may well see this in later episodes too, that the contrast between using that communication style when speaking to the public or your kind of consumers and using that communication style amongst your staff are very, very different things. Because as he says, I'm not going to let, you know, the piss take parties is going to stop now, and that pretty much informs what he's going to say here. But if you're speaking to your staff, I think that you have to frame that in a different way. So it's interesting to see that Charlie can do very well amongst one set of people, but as we'll see later, it doesn't quite work out.
Yeah, like that was something we looked at in the previous episode, the way he kind of spoke to the, remember when they were talking about it, the interest payments being 7 million and none of the staff that were in that meeting seemed to know.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of like, you know, this is part of the problem, you're part of the problem, was the way it kind of came across. Whereas in this meeting, he sits in and he's just like, well, look, we've just inherited a shit show of a club, to quote himself there, and that how Sunderland are being shafted in deal after deal after deal. I think that comes across very well to the fans, because of course the fans did not like the previous owner and the previous regime in the end. So of course, if you just, you know, stick the boot into them, it comes across quite well. He did, again though, Charlie did throw the staff under the bus, that he said, you know, even the staff didn't comprehend how badly run it was. And you're kind of thinking, okay, this works outside, but inside?
Yeah, that was another kind of one of those links I spoke about earlier that does make you think about that moment where he said the very, very open of episode one, as you just said, like, oh, none of you have read this, none of you know this. Very bizarre. But it does seem like, you know, we don't really see that much of Charlie in this episode, and it is a lot about Stuart. So the next scene cuts to Stuart in Oxfordshire. He's playing football in his back garden. You hear his backstory a little bit. Oxford United get mentioned, you know, his boyhood club used to see them. You see some sepia-tinged video footage, which I guess softens the blow of last podcast where we were kind of questioning that a little bit. Okay, so it's a little bit more sort of reasonable now we get that. And he says, you know, why he runs a football club, which I think is really, really cool. He says that he's going to do it the old-fashioned way, which is kind of the he said it moment of this episode.
So getting involved in Sunderland gave me a chance to run a football club in what I perceive was an old-fashioned way, whereby everyone would feel that they own their football club again.
Like, he's extremely evocative in the way he talks as well. And I think you're kind of getting the idea of how he wants to return to that club that, you know, like he said in the meetings and like Charlie said in the Seaburn Supporters Club, is that he wants to have the fans club there, that he's evocatively talking about the terraces there. And it's such a normal thing he's talking about, where everyone is standing in the stands at the smells of cigarettes and burgers on a Tuesday night. That's he just wants to create this warm feeling of his childhood almost. There's a Citizen Kane almost aspect to that.
You do see his passion for football in this little segment, and you kind of learn a little bit more of Stuart's backstory, as you said, Tom, a little bit more about the character and why he's in the business. But you kind of contrast quite later when you see the conversation about dealing with agents, which is a much newer factor of football and something he's anti compared to the old-fashioned way of just kind of dealing with the players and on the pitch, as you put it.
Yeah, certainly. I think with Stuart, it's his relatability that makes him compelling as a protagonist, I suppose, in this particular setting. I think he is just one of those people who we have the sympathy of, as I mentioned earlier on. I'm sure he's a capable guy. I'm sure he's kind of, you know, his background is one thing, but the enthusiasm and I think the kind of the unassuming nature. I mean, obviously he does have some preconceptions, but he does come across not as naive, but unassuming and just a bit of a nice guy, like the kind of guy you feel like you could be or you could know. And that shepherds you towards liking him a little bit, doesn't it? And his explanation of why he bought a football club definitely is something which is going to resonate with lots of people. And I completely understand that viewpoint. But we buy a football club if we could, guys. Would you do it?
Would love to. But getting in a position to buy a football club is
take all that to one side. But like if say you could just, you know, you had the bank balance, all the other stuff was taken care of, you know, like in films that like everyone's rich, so they don't have to bother worrying about money. So if all that was taken to one side and it was just a football club, you were Stuart Donald or something like that, would you do it?
I personally totally would. I think I've really enjoyed watching quite a few of these football documentaries that kind of chart what it's like to be on the ownership or the management side of football clubs. I feel you'll say that they were financial doping, maybe, if you wanted to give a contrary view. But the class of 92's documentaries, they're out of their league and in a league of their own or whatever they were that they were called, with both BBC and Sky looking at managing that club, was really interesting too. And I think it's... Is this part of the problem with football club ownership, is that everyone who's a fan thinks they can do it and they think they understand it, but there's a multitude of problems and difficulties that come with it that make it so hard?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with you there, Stag. I would probably give it a go if I had this infinite bank balance, didn't have to worry about a job or anything like that, and could dedicate all my energy to just running a football club. You know, why not? Yeah, I think it would be a very exciting thing to do. As you said, there's lots of other elements. Unfortunately, you have to get involved. You mentioned the class of 92. I remember Gary Neville having to deal with the local council over building the pitch and dealing with, you know, I think people were burning effigies of him virtually. He's having to deal with a lot of crap there, but apart from that, I think, yeah, it'd be pretty good to do.
I think so. I feel like it would be a bit of a thankless task, though, because it's one thing to say, yeah, I own a football club, but the follow-up that's kind of just occurred to me as we've been speaking about this is, what sort of owner would you be if you were kind of the guardian angel, the VC who was just coming in and doing what Ella Short was doing? Are you just signing checks, or are you the sort of owner who's, you know, promoting this self-sustaining model, or are you the sort of owner who's going to be taking it one step further, like the Greek owners all seem to be, in the dressing room wielding guns and then threatening their managers? How would you run a football club? So I think if I was a VC, limitless pots of gold, who was just signing stuff up, I think that's great. I'd do that. That'd be great fun, because you'd just always be that guy who the fans would love you, because just putting all the money in regardless, you get good people around you, would be able to sort things out. If you're a self-sustaining guy, I think it's easy to be a figure of hatred. Like, if it doesn't go very well and you're just like, no, we're sticking to the plan, we're sticking to our philosophy of self-sustaining. I think Stan Kroenke maybe at Arsenal, like, the fact that you're not putting money in because you're sticking to a strategy can easily be turned into a rod to beat you with. And obviously you don't want to be that owner who just, like, I don't know why I said Greek. I think I meant the Italian owners, you know, Cellino, that sort of owner who's just constantly interfering. Like, no one wants that sort of owners. I wouldn't want to be that guy. I think I'd only want to do it if I had someone like in charge who was like a football person, and I was just signing the checks, and it's like maybe an Abramovich with a Mourinho in front of him. Maybe that's who I'd love to be.
Raj Zahn, I think if you watch the Leeds documentary, I kind of like his style of ownership, to be honest. He does have the element that he is trying to self-sustain the club. Obviously, that's very hard in the Championship when it's all about succeeding and gaining that promotion into the Premier League. But he also comes across very pragmatic, doesn't interfere too much, but pays attention enough that he would go to the matches and follow the club. So, I think you can get that kind of level right. I think, obviously, the Class 92 as well, they try and stay off as much as possible, keep a clear ownership of the club, though obviously with them there's a bit more bankrolling and a bit less profit making. But at the end of the day, owning a football club's not meant to be about turning a profit. And in this hypothetical scenario, it's not about an investment which you're looking to make money from. It's about investing in the club and looking at the long-term goals and ultimately, achieving success with the club, and that will require a certain amount of spending money.
But I would think that part of the trick is that you need to take a club that's maybe at a low ebb but is large and has potential, like Sunderland, in this position. Because you would think then that your little bit of money and a bit of stellar management would turn the tide. And I guess it's easy to fall into the Stuart Donald trap, and maybe that's why even if you give this a bit of thought, you could still sympathise with him, because that self-funding model is, of course, the more romantic view, and maybe from a commercial sense, it's probably the nicer view. I think as an owner, I would struggle to be any less involved than Stuart Donald is, put it that way. I think I'd like to be at every game. I'd like to be able to go into the terraces. I'd like to try and be able to engage with fans and to be transparent and to be, I guess, almost like a face of it. I certainly couldn't do an Abramovich thing where you're just kind of just there in the box signing checks and nobody quite knows what you think or what you want from it. But what I do like as well, FSG have a bit an aspect of this, but certainly the man who owns FC Mittelland and Brentford and a few other clubs, if I remember correctly, that he's all about trying to instill his own philosophy in terms of he's a professional gambler, and so he tries to use all sorts of different like statistical modelling techniques and emotional behaviour modelling techniques to try and put together the right type of squad with the right type of people in the most efficient way possible, and emphasising stuff like free kicks where there is a higher probability of scoring than open play. And I like that idea of it, and so bringing that sort of new thinking into a club, which is much easier to say sitting here on a podcast on a random Monday night than it is to actually do in practice. But that would be in my own romantic idea what I would like to do if I was.
So Matthew Bentham sort of thing for you, Daniel Radzani for Nick, and I think I'd be Joe Lewis, wouldn't I, of Spurs, and just put Daniel Levy in front of me to be a lightning rod. I'd just sign my checks and get on with it and live on a lovely island in the Bahamas. Right, so back to the show, and we're back in training. Jack Ross speak to the camera in his lovely Scottish brogue on being a realist. It's League One, it's difficult, but cut to an interview with young starlet Josh Marger, who says, there's good energy coming from him, and it's been very, very good, and Jack Ross has been great with him and giving him that trust to keep him going forward. This is all interrupted by a slide that says that they need to tie the young players down before the January transfer window. This is a juxtapose of a scene where Stuart Donald is again with his council of war, as it were, and he's saying, he's not signing agents, he's signing players, but dealing with agents, as Nick mentioned earlier, is becoming more and more annoying. They're looking at the young players that they've got hold of and the young players they don't. I mean, talk about Marger, obviously. He scored lots of goals, as we've been told and shown. So he's the guy they really want to tie down. And Richard Hill says, Marger's demurring, and it's difficult for players to recalibrate their expectations from Premier League to League One. Stuart Donald saying that, that really there's a lot of stuff going on. But he does say this.
Josh has had a cracking offer. Yes. He'll sign that. We're hearing all sorts, but, Tottenham have been to watch him.
Which I guess is meant to make you think that he still holds hope, I suppose, but that interest from other clubs, there's some real foreshadowing here, isn't it? And it seems those agents, his agent at least, is out circulating Marge's name everywhere. And we hear about this more and more as the episode goes on. I think this is a good time to talk about agents, because I think in some ways that is positioned as being the new sort of usurper force against the old-fashioned pure way of doing football ownership or doing football as a business in general. So agents, guys, obviously a big impact on Sunderland, and we'll find out later on in this episode with Marger, but just in general, what do you think their impact is on football? How would you regulate them, if at all?
So I think with agents, like broadly, I don't think there'll be many people who'll go against us when we say that they probably have a negative influence in football and that they perhaps at times prey on the vulnerability of younger players who they get onto their books, and perhaps they have more motivations than just looking after their client, the agent. And I think that is no more epitomized really than what we've seen with Mino Raiola over the past few years. He was paid £41 million to transfer Paul Pogba from Juventus to Manchester United. Now, that might sound ridiculous in and of itself, but when you realize that he was paid by all three parties to that transfer, United, Juventus and Paul Pogba, you get an idea of the sort of thing that's going on. Juventus paid him to bid up the price. It wasn't a sell-on that they agreed there. Raiola was actually contracted by United to secure the transfer itself, and Pogba's role or what he was paying for is quite obvious here. And the Guardian report that this idea where agents are working on both sides of deals is actually quite common, and once the clubs kind of waive the idea that the agent needs to be impartial, it's fine. This is just how it is. And that's obviously not an ideal scenario and just causes unnecessary expense in what is an already inflated monetarily sport.
Yeah, I think it's sickening, really. I think for many owners, really, in terms of the amount of money that the agents are picking up. So often you look at the agent and you think, actually, are they acting in the player's best interest, or are they acting in their own interest, really? Because ultimately, if they can broker the deal, broker the moves between the clubs, then they're going to get a huge pay packet as part of it. And you see that later on in the episode when they talk a little bit more about Marge's agent and what his motivations might be in this particular scenario. But yeah, often they're kind of, you know, this hidden figure in football that we don't really know too much about. But, you know, they wield so much power, especially if they can sort of get into sort of these young players, some of them 16, 17 years old, and essentially come knocking on the door saying, I'll be your agent. I can get you that dream move to Manchester United. I can do this. I can get you here. I can put your name out there. And, you know, essentially sell them a story about the fact that they might be earning £100,000 a week or something in a couple of years if they go with this particular individual. And it's a dark area of football, and one that's really sort of grown over the past 10 years as football has become more and more a commercial business as opposed to about the sport. And I think you see that in sort of Stuart, you know, when he talks about the old fashioned way, that he really sort of disagrees with this sort of element of the football business.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, in The Secret Footballer, he speaks about this a little bit, and it's still flabbergasts me that an agent can represent both his client and represent the club in the same transaction. That is absolutely mind-blowing that you can take a cut for both parts of the deal. Like, it really does feel like the Wild West of football in a lot of ways, that even these sort of basic things that you look at and think, that can't be right. No one's looked at it, or if they've looked at it and there's been such resistance to the way things are going because these guys have got so much de facto power that like people don't want to mess with them because all of these players are in their pockets effectively. Like Ferguson was saying about Pogba, that when he left Juventus, they had no chance because they realised that Raiola had ingratiated himself with his family. So anything that Ferguson was saying was just being disregarded by Pogba, who was completely on the side of Raiola. On this subject, so FIFA last year announced a number of rule changes. So they wanted to limit the fees agents can earn from clients' transfers, because I just mentioned you can represent both your client, the buying club and the selling club, in the same deal. So the new rules included limiting the amount an agent representing a selling club can receive. I think it's 10% per transfer fee, amongst a few other things. But this body I only learned existed a few months ago, the Association of Football Agents, hit back at the proposals, and Raiola gave an impassioned speech in front of them, saying that it was their right to earn their money however they wanted, to cheers and thunderous applause from the agent body, who all lined up for selfies with him afterwards. These FIFA edicts were described as a body blow from which many of our members will never recover. But the bold facts are pretty crazy. So FIFA uses an international transfer matching system to basically do transfers. That's how they're done, you know, the faxing and all this sort of thing. Figures from last December 2019, showed that $653 million, which is £500 million, were spent on commissions to agents and intermediaries alone last year. clubs in England, France, Germany, Italy, Portugal and Spain accounted for 80% of the total spend on commission. And Portuguese clubs spent half of their total transfer fee money on agents and intermediaries, which is absolutely crazy. And most of that went to Jorge Mendes and Gestefute. So the impact of these guys wield is absolutely immense. And the fact their tentacles are into everything surely makes it very difficult to row back from, because it is such a dark, furtive corner. They're so skilled in the dark arts. They've got so many players who ultimately wield the power, like it or not, in football at the moment, in their back pocket, that it's hard to see how they can row back. It's such a dereliction of duty that we've got to this situation in the first place, isn't it?
What's difficult about football and what makes agents so, you could just say, nefarious, is that footballers often come from socioeconomically difficult backgrounds, and they may not have education, a lot of the players. Sometimes they don't have come from a family that has high levels of education as well. So these agents really have them, because of course the riches that football offers and the life-changing sums that it offers, for not just for the player, but for the families involved as well, it means that they can really prey on their vulnerabilities. And of course, the thing with football as well is that at 16 years old, there are thousands of players who still think they can make it at, let's say, a top five European league level. And what sometimes can make the difference is getting the training. It's getting to the clubs to actually get the trials and being taken on board. And what these agents offer is, because they have, as Tom said, their tentacles and everything, is they offer contacts, they offer opportunities. Sometimes they might get a trial just because the agent is owed one back from some contact or something that they set up previously. And it's that soft influence that they have sometimes, it's not just the hard cash, that makes it so difficult to understand, and trying to deal with that, to register it, to audit that, is just so difficult. Like FIFA have already, we've seen the clear issues they've had in trying to limit, let's say, using percentages of revenues with financial fair play, that clubs will find a way around it, and no more. And also with bringing young players into clubs and paying parents, clubs have found ways around that limitlessly, it seems. And so no more than that, with anything that is done to regulate agents, is going to be extremely difficult to police and to actually implement in the first place.
Absolutely. It's such a difficult issue, and I think to use one of Nick's catchphrases, it's tough. It's probably, in fact, too tough to deal with on this particular podcast. But I guess bringing it back to Sunderland Till I Die, this scene is paired with a scene which is basically a sequence, a montage, to underline how important Josh Marger is to Sunderland. You know, Marger goal, goal again, Kevin Phillips saying he's massive for them, another Marger goal, the Wise Men Say podcast say they like his arrogance, the AFL Matters show say that, you know, if the numbers had continued, he'd have been the best finisher ever. Jack Ross was saying that he was going to, you know, was hoping that he was going to stay, he'd develop him. You know, in that season, Josh Marger had 15 goals in 24 appearances in League One. So, yeah, pretty damn decent. That scene kind of all seems to exist just to underline what's been said before and foreshadow what's to come as well. That this guy is just their talisman. He's the guy who's putting the ball in the back of the net for them. And this is again kind of paired with a scene where they're at the Roker Report, another Sunderland podcast. Stuart Donald's in the studio. He's talking about contracts and the way contracts are set up. Again, that kind of theme of Sunderland being shafted really comes through.
What we've done is put it completely the wrong way around, so that actually Josh get in the first team in earnest, playing week in, week out, and their agents then see a value to them. So we're now forced to negotiate with the agent, thinking, oh, I can make more money if he moves away than he can at Sunderland. So as an agent, I'm going to try and make more money by getting him a move.
He says that they need to put a lot of money on the table to placate the agent. So yeah, I guess continuing this theme of the agents being involved.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Again, what he says in the Roker report, it's almost foreshadowing that if Marger leaves the club, it's not necessarily Stuart Donald's fault. It's the fault, again, of the previous management and the previous administration, because of the fact that, you know, these players have been put on these three-year contracts and they haven't built in any sort of one-year extension into them. You know, contracts are very complex things these days with footballers, but there wasn't any evidence, obviously, in the third year, if he starts playing at this point, he's essentially saying it should have some form of clause to say if Marger plays 10 games or plays 5 games, that he automatically gets a one-year extension, because it's within that third year that, you know, that the eyes start to look at him and, you know, the media will start to get interested in this player, and they've basically got to try and then renew all these players on new full contracts, just as just at that particular moment when they're starting to emerge as real players. So, yeah, it's very interesting what Stuart says there on the Roker Report podcast, kind of saying, look, these players are on these really bad contracts. And yeah, that comes up again later in the episode as well in regards to the contracts.
What's interesting is that Stuart looks at the fact that, okay, that the ghost of management past has kind of screwed them in terms of the contracts for those younger players, but also is the agent issue again crops up there. The fact that just the agents can make more money if Josh Madja moves club. And that's the bottom line of the issue.
When you get to the final 6 months of contracts, as everybody knows, your value is, well, as low as it could possibly be. So speak to foreign clubs, but not clubs in the same nation. So yeah, it just seems like, you know, all these sorts of comments about this agent being the sort of guy who has a history of moving his clients abroad definitely comes to the fore here. And it does just look like there's a lot of negligence in the past. I'm not even sure whether this is due to Ellis Short being the guy who's writing the checks. I think it just kind of speaks to other levels of incompetence that were around the club if this sort of thing has been allowed to happen as well. But you've got players who, you know, as Nick said, have just on these sorts of ropey deals that don't really protect the club and don't provide that sort of insurance policy. It just looks like, you know, ultimately there's nothing they can really do, as Stuart says. And the way that they've negotiated the contracts just seems to be incredibly dumb. So yeah, it just seems like a bit of a tough gig all round for Stewie.
Yeah, exactly. I think it would be remiss to say that a lot of the previous problems within Sunderland were Ellis Short's fault. Ellis Short was essentially just giving the administration team a lot of money, you know, giving them plenty of money to spend. It's the fact that they spent it so poorly. There's probably a reason why Ellis Short said this is a done deal. I'm not giving any more money to this club because I'm losing millions. I kind of understand from that perspective, to be honest, in regards to Ellis Short. Obviously, he wanted to be a distant, you know, own from a distance and not get too heavily involved in the administration and just be the money man. But the money was spent so poorly and administrated so poorly as well.
So yeah. Segueing from spending money, we now go back to Luke 09, a jovial character who was introduced to us in the last episode, who you know, genuinely seems overawed, as we mentioned, by the likes of Brian Oviedo and Aidan McGeady. So he's hanging out with Josh Madja. You know, he says Madja's having a tough time. And he's talking about himself as well, about how he's trying too hard. Jack Ross gave him the fantastic advice to remember the player you are, aka he watched The Lion King and seen Remember Who You Are and thought, yeah, I'll tell the player that. He's definitely dumb enough to believe it. And 09 saying, oh, you know, it really just spoke to me. Those them simple words just made, you know, made everything right. Yeah. Anyway, we move to a game. The commentator is mispronouncing 09's name all the way through. God, I was outraged. He was calling O'Neill. Can't believe it. But yeah, we have this sort of fantastic dramatic payoff when he scores a goal. Madja scores again and again. And there's kind of the, I think it kind of moves between lots of football matches, but you kind of see 09 and Madja celebrating because Madja's just scored his 10th goal of the season.
You got number 10. Madja doesn't seem to realise that he'd scored his 10th goal of the season whatsoever.
And probably 09 doesn't care.
Definitely, yeah, exactly. He's like, I'm going to score 10 in Ligue 1 at the end of this year is what he's doing.
Yeah, on the plane at this point. Oh, spoilers.
you can see the happiness of Luke 09. Almost, he's kind of an innocent, quite a likeable kid, but they actually show Stuart Donald in the crowd and he's got like a face of thunder. I don't know if that was that particular moment they choose to use or if that was like later in the game they just did it for dramatic effect, but it shows that whilst everything's happy on the pitch, 09 and Madja are smiling and celebrating together, all is not well in reality when it comes to Josh Madja.
Yeah, I mean, the season does like really progress. Like, you kind of have gone from August all the way to October, November by this point. And it's incredible how spliced up football matches kind of put in to highlight the point and move time on. Really works as a device to show that sort of passing of time, the chronology, because the next thing, it's November and they're sitting in a pub at the management team. And Richard Hill, I think head of football operations, says, you know, the limit's been reached and Josh Marge's agent is basically taking them all for a ride. If he goes overseas, he says the agent will get £1 million. Stuart says, oh, the family trusts the agent, speaking about, you know, what we were talking about earlier. And Richard Hill says, you know, it's nothing to do with Madja, it's all about the agent. Why would you want to leave? They all ask. You know, Stuart Donham saying, you know, football's changed, he's negotiating with a lot of people. And he also says it doesn't look very good for them if Madja does go.
If Josh Madja leaves us, we're going to look like a bunch of numpties.
the final scene is Marja. He's in an interview and he's being asked the transfer speculation. And he says, oh, that's interesting. And he just looks non-committal, doesn't he? He's smiling wryly and he just looks so dodgy, like so sketchy. Like, you know, he's got all that body language, you know, his hands patting the seat, looks every inch the untrustworthy man. He could not sound more non-committal when he said how he's feeling.
I'm here right now, so that's it. That's football for you.
And I guess the final talking point for this week's podcast is on Josh Marja. Like, not the final talk about Josh Marja, which I think is going to come next week. Spoiler, it was Stack spoiler earlier. But dramatically here, I think he's been portrayed as the antagonist. He's the kind of the enemy, the embodiment of this sort of new invading force in football. But is it fair on him? In some ways, I think producers really do stitch him up, don't they, for representing him this way.
I think at the end of the day, I still feel he's relatively sympathetic character. You are talking about an 18-year-old clip, and you saw the clip before where they say it's not about him, it's about the agent. And at the end of the day, the agent is selling him the dream of more money. You have to look at his position. He was with Sunderland as an academy player when he was in the Premier League, and they've since suffered two relegations. He's now broken through into the first team. He's scored 10 goals in whatever, you know, 13, 14 games. He's on fire, performing well. And there are rumours of, and I'm sure his agent's in his ears, rumours of the likes of Spurs and other clubs interested in him, and potential for an overseas move. And these moves will include a massive pay for him. And they've also factored in the fact that, I think as Richard said earlier, that, you know, Marja, your players talk, he'll be aware of the amount of money that the likes of Lee Catamol, for instance, is going to be earning at this particular moment in time for the club. And what's being offered to him, as we saw at the beginning of the episode, that, you know, League One players only earn $2,000 a week. You know, we could be talking a tiny salary and potentially, you know, a 4-year contract or something like that, which he's not going to be interested in if his contract's running out and there's a potential that he could earn, you know, 10 times that in a Premier League club or a Ligue 1 club. So I understand. And at this stage, his future is very much up in the air. So you can understand why he's going to be non-committal. He's not going to say to the documentary makers, oh, I love the club, I'm going to be here for the next 5 years, I'm going to, you know, Sunderland means everything to me. When if that's not actually the reality, and he knows in his heart of hearts that he's going to be moving. But he's also not going to say the opposite, is he?
For me, he reminds me in that at the end of a Shakespearean Jesus. Character giving a soliloquy. I'm here right now, so that's it. That's football for you. That's me, you know, with the creepy hand gesture thing in the back. You know, they show him kind of touching the pad that he's sitting on as well. Oh, it plays off so awfully. And I think when you consider where that episode had started with, you know, all these media types and Joyce in the kitchen talking about how all the lads love to be at the club and it's so great that everything's kind of coming back together. And then you've got him at the end kind of sinisterly tapping away as he plots his way out of the club. It is kind of difficult. And I think, as Tom says, he has been stitched up a bit. And as Nick says, there is good reason why a player like him would want to move to make more money. You're a footballer. You've got 17 years of a career if you do really, really, really well for yourself. And you kind of need to maximize your earnings potential in that time.
Absolutely. I think Nick's got it right that I think he's in a lose-lose situation, because anything he says, then put next to what he actually does, which is going to Bordeaux, is going to make him look bad, whatever the case. Like, if he had, as Nick said, oh yeah, I love the club, I'm not going anywhere, he would have looked terrible. As it stands, he's being non-committal. He can't say, yeah, I'm on the way out, because, I mean, would you do that if you were that guy? I don't think you would either. But either way,
your negotiations are going to be, you will be doing yourself out of your deal probably. In terms of, like, oh, the other clubs know that you're definitely leaving and that you've abandoned your chance of signing a contract with the club you're at. So your best thing to do, and the agent probably would have told him, is just stay quiet, say nothing, don't mess this up. I'll handle it. And Josh Marja is very happy to just say, my agent handles this. I don't know. I don't read the paper. I concentrate on football. Yeah. Cliche.
Exactly. But I still think the way that he is put up and the way that they do it does cast him as that proxy for the the bratty, you know, mercenary culture that they're trying to say that football has become, the antithesis to Stuart's sort of utopian dream of the old-fashioned way. The Final Cut, like, it just reminded me, I was saying to you guys earlier, like L.A. Noire, that computer game, that you're a detective, you know, it's an interrogation to speak into witnesses and suspects and sort of things, and they'd all be writhing, you know, making little actions with their face and things like that to influence your decision. You could, you know, say, oh yeah, he's telling the truth, it's a lie, or you can use doubt, and everything that Marge says and everything he kind of looks like, you know, tapping the table, as you said, just screams doubt here. It just doesn't look very good for him. It is a lose-lose situation, but just look at, if you do, obviously do take have a beer or something beforehand, but look up Marjorie as a snake on social media. Like, the guy had an absolute hammering because of this, and arguably the program makers will say that there's no way we could have done it any differently, but I do think that it was a little bit unwarranted, and it did make him look worse than he actually was. Like, as Nick said, probably the agent is the person who is the dark villain. He's just a bit of a front man, a bit of a lightning rod for the criticism that you receive.
I mean, there's sort of parallels, I guess, in the last series with Lewis Graben, who I think left in the January window after being sort of their leading scorer in the Championship, and now you've got it with Josh Madger, and you just see, you know, you saw it with the Sunderland fans when Graben scored against them. You know, they're hurling abuse with him. They were hurling abuse at I think it was Darren Bent as well, because it was another former Sunderland player that was, you know, supposedly a snake for leaving. So it seems to be a common theme there, really, in terms of trying to hang on to the forwards. But ultimately, as I said, you know, it's an 18-year-old boy, and probably what they're offering in terms of cash, because they're now a League One club, it's completely different to what he would have been offered if he was a Premier League player or even a Championship player at this particular moment in time and coming through the main squad. So, you know, I personally do sympathise with the player in terms of the decisions that he's got to make and his own career path, which may be very different to Sunderland's, unfortunately, at this stage.
I think just with so many of these things in football, it's just so easy for us to kind of sit on the terrace or in a webcam at home and looking at from afar and to think, wow, how selfish he is. Wow, this is the wrong thing to do. But once you stick yourself in his shoes or any player's shoes in an awful lot of situations that don't involve Kyle Walker, you're going to feel sorry for him. And like, players have huge amount of external pressure on them. Luke O'Neill actually talks about that in the episode itself, with people always advising them what to do. Oh, you should totally be doing this. Oh, you need to consider that. For an 18-year-old kid, or even for someone who's 30 years old who has only existed in the world of football, that's difficult to deal with. And when you try to empathise with a player, I think often you're going to end up just feeling sorry for them.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, he's a young guy, doesn't really know any better. Like, we all, well, apart from Newstag, but those people are watching it with the benefit of age/experience. Yeah, I guess you got to try to put yourself in his shoes and empathise if you are the sort of person who's saying, oh, what a snake. Because the reality is that he's just going to make the best decision for himself. And you would too if you were him. I don't think that you'd be kind of thinking, yeah, I'm just going to stay at Sunderland out of loyalty or something like that. It just seems like blind loyalty or something like that. If you were doing that, you always want to better yourself, right? It makes
but Josh Madger has probably seen that, like, what would he be loyal to? Like, he saw the players a year earlier, all of them have their heads chewed off by the fans. You know, it's like, he knows that it's a fickle thing at the best of times. It seems to be, just given the boom bust cycle Sunderland have been in, it seems particularly fickle there. And the frustration is even extremely difficult to deal with, I would imagine. It's a hard to escape. It's the one club in the city, etc. You can kind of see why the easier option and the more lucrative option was just to go.
Yeah, it's not like he's actually from the area as well. Like George Honeyman, he's from Lewisham in London. So, you know, he's moved up north, far away potentially from where the rest of his family are. And, you know, it's not a city that he's sort of grown up with. And, you know, he's kind of expected that he wouldn't be spending his entire career in Sunderland, because essentially, as he kind of implied, he owes them nothing, really. You know, he's been there for a couple of years and they've brought him through the youth academy, but he's got his whole career ahead of him, hasn't he?
If he had 1 year on his deal, let's say in Stuart Donald's ideal world, come the next summer, whether they got promoted or not, thanks to his goals, they'd have probably been looking to force him out of the club to get a fee. That's, you know, the bottom line is that, like, he left now, but, you know, if the shoe was on a different foot, he'd probably still be outside that club now in 2020.
Well, he hasn't left. He hasn't left yet in this particular little bubble. Just to use that word one more time in this podcast of the show. But yeah, no, as the scene closes on him looking decidedly shifty, it fades to black and we get to the end credits. So, did we like this episode, gents?
In a nutshell, yeah. I think, again, what I like about Sunderland Until I Die is the way that it gives us an insight into the problems and the developments of in football, using one club as just a proxy to tell that story and using different characters within the club to obviously help bring us along. And yet again, I think, especially with the agency problem that we've discussed so much on this pod, they've done a brilliant job on this one.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's another good episode of the series. A lot of talking points, lots of discussions that we've had. And I'm certainly looking forward to the next part. It's got me hooked and, you know, it left on that sort of, you know, cliffhanger moment, as you'd put it, for a TV drama with sort of Josh Madger sitting there, you know, looking, very unsteady, which kind of, you know, my wife was asking me questions, oh, what's going to happen next with Josh Madger? And I said, well, you've got to wait and see. So, you know, plenty of talking points for watchers.
Certainly, I like the way they can pack it all in. For me, though, this episode really did feel like a bridging episode. It was half an hour, and I felt like they were using an opportunity to set a lot of reference points for our memories. So later on, we go, yeah, I remember that was important because he did this. And I remember that was important because they said this. It felt like a collage of lots of snippets of things to me while they're moving on the sort of narrative. It felt like nothing really happened at the club in this period. So they were kind of trying to draw out some of the themes, which are going to then be really untangled later on. Didn't read too much of Charlie either, and I think that it was really kind of narrowly just kind of focused on Stuart Donald and his vision for the club. And I think it did do a good job of setting, as I've said a few times, Stuart as the protagonist and Josh Marger and agents as the antagonist. And I like that sort of conflict that's set up for the next episode to come. So it's pride, passion and loyalty is the next one, so I'm guessing we can infer what happens in the next episode. But yeah, there we go. I thought it was quite good.
Just to say, we are, of course, Who Got the Assist. You'll find the Twitter account for Tom at WGTA_FPL. Nick is at WGTA_Nick. And I'm at FPL Stag. We're also over on Instagram at WGTA.FPL. We will indeed, as Tom said, be back next week.
Cool. All right. Well, as I mentioned, we'll be back next time to talk about Season 2, Episode 3. 45 minutes here, much longer episode than this one. Pride, Passion and Loyalty. We hope to see you watch Sunderland Until I Die better.
Thanks for listening and being a loyal listener during this fallow period. Stay safe all. Cheers, guys.
See ya.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.